and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The day today is June 15th, 2023, and this is episode 383. You are listening to Radio Warnerd at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd, where you can get the Warnerd newsletters and other goodies. Anyway, I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, and I am in Silicon Valley hell currently. So my mic might sound a little different. I'm out here helping my mother after an operation. So I'm out in Cupertino, and I'm on the line first with the Warnerd himself, Gary Brecher, a.k.a. John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Apulia or Puglia. John, how you doing?
Pretty good. We've got an exciting interview, and I'm just looking forward to that. I'm just in the boonies of Salento, where it's very hot and grassy and windy, which is like a hay fever dream.
And we are on the line with a friend of the show, Ben Aris. Ben coming to us from Berlin. He, of course, is the editor and founder of BNE and Telenews. And he's done a few episodes with us in the lead up to the war and during the war, giving us the kind of the European slash German perspective on the war. Also, Ben, I knew going way back in Moscow, so he also knows Russia quite well, going back a few decades. He was, episode 365 of Radio Warnerd, episode 338, episode 320, episode 316. So you can go back and I'll post these also, previous episodes with Ben. Anyway, first of all, Ben, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be here, Mark. Good to see you again.
Good to talk to you again, too. And, you know, I'd love to talk to you about fun old memories, but we're back to, you know, sorry, man, it's a war podcast and there's a war going on. And you know.
Yeah, when we were young.
Yes, exactly. you know, I first of all, you just published a piece. I mean, I know one of the big angles we want to talk with you about, and that you've, through your news organization, your reporting and everything, you have a really good sense of the economic side of the war. Which has also been very, it has not gone according to how you would think it would go, as sort of like the kinetic war itself. But yeah. You just posted a piece also about the big Ukrainian counteroffensive, and we were just talking about it. And you know, a lot of people are talking about it. There's a lot of, I would say, you know, if you read the Western press, the Anglo press, especially the, you know, US, UK, the mood has been that sort of gung-ho overconfidence is definitely not there. And there's almost a sense of slow, quiet. I don't know if panic is quite the right word yet, but definitely concern that things are not going too well. But you're... you see things slightly differently. So why don't you tell us what you're seeing yourself, and then also what it looks like from Germany.
Indeed. Well, there's two wars going on. The first one is the kinetic war, and that's very specific between Russia and Ukraine on the ground with guns. And you know, exclusively Ukrainian soldiers are fighting Russian soldiers. And the West is... you know, supporting Ukraine by supplying it with arms. But the West's NATO, Stoltenberg, the NATO chairman, said very specifically at the start of the kinetic war that his number one priority was not to get into Third World War with Russia. And so what they've done is they've made sure that they've supplied Ukraine with arms enough so that it doesn't get defeated, but they're very scared of giving it offensive weapons. And that, because the problem is, so far they can argue, look, we're helping our friend Ukraine defend itself. But if we give offensive weapons, long-range missiles, you know, the modern tanks, and now the debate is on the F-16s, then those are offensive weapons. And they're terrified that Russia will change its line and say, look, you're no longer defending Ukraine. You're using Ukraine as a proxy to attack Russia. So this is a NATO attack on Russia by Ukraine by NATO forces using Ukraine as a proxy. And then Russia would take, if it takes that line, then it could do something crazy like bomb, you know, ammo dump in Poland. And then that triggers Article 5 and you're into Third World War.
Or like what Karaganov was proposing, right, the other day, Sergei Karaganov, you know, let's make the nuclear threat real.
The nuclear option, because, an attack on Russia is an existential attack. Yeah. And under the Russian nuclear doctrine, that if they deem an attack to be existential, then that allows them to use nuclear weapons. And Russia has these tactical nukes. Unlike the States, which has big bombs, Russia has all these small half-kilo bombs that can do something like flatten the center of Kiev. But then the idea there, I mean, it does as much damage as a very big conventional bomb, but you can use them to scare the West into climbing down. And nobody's quite sure what they would do if they set off, you know, hit Dnipropetrovsk or somewhere like that with a tactical nuke, and arguing that we're being attacked by NATO. And, you know, no one wants to go into a full-scale nuclear exchange. Yeah. But the second war is the economic war, and that is very definitely, you know, NATO, the West, US, G7 attacking Russia economically and trying to destroy its economy in order to make it, you know, impossible to perpetrate this war, to basically starve it of funds. Unfortunately, neither war is going well, in so much as the kinetic war is ground to a stalemate over the last 16 months. Ukraine, of course, is now launching its counteroffensive, but we can talk about that in a minute. I mean, our line on that is the counteroffensive hasn't started because we haven't seen the main stockpile of troops, you know, hundreds of tanks and divisions that have been, 12 battalions that have been trained in Germany. They're not on the field yet. There's been one Leopard tank, one of these German-made Leopard tanks. And the economic war is also not going well because the idea was then to cut Russia off from its oil revenue, and that's failed completely. Russia's earning just as much oil money from oil as before. To cut Russia off from technology, that's also failed completely. Russia's actually importing now more microchips than it was pre-war.
Thanks is that the first use through Armenia or
yeah,
or China,
Armenia,
or
Kyrgyzstan, Georgia?
Right.
You know, there's a whole long list of countries. It boils down to you can't close down the global market, and if you're exporting, then, you know, you can stop the exports from the US directly to Russia, but you can't stop the exports, you know, from the US to Armenia, to Kyrgyzstan, and then to Abkhazia, and then to China, and then back through Singapore, and then boom, it ends up in Moscow. The chain's too long. It's impossible to police.
Right.
And Russia has too many friends in between that are willing to buy these chips and then export them on to secondary countries, third countries, fourth countries before they finally end up in Russia. And so Russia has actually completely evaded the technology sanctions as far. And the US State Department has sort of admitted that. It's a game of whack-a-mole. I mean, you have to nail down the holes. And there's just too many holes. I don't think it's possible, or it's extremely difficult to do. So they're talking about an 11th package of sanctions now, and there's no new sanctions in that package whatsoever. They're all to do with secondary sanctions on companies that are facilitating this. But each time you nail down one of the holes, a new one's going to spring up. So it's very frustrating. I mean, like you were alluding to, Mark, I think they're getting a bit frustrated in the West that the economic war is also not going very well.
Yeah. I mean, it hasn't gone according to anybody's plan. Putin had a quick, easy victory plan for the initial war, and it didn't go that way. The West had this nuclear, you know, economic war strategy, which was, I mean, I remember how they talked, like Russia was going to run out of, nothing was going to work by like June or July of last year.
It has to be said that, you know, the sanctions against Russia are not totally effective. It causes lots of problems, and there are things that it's struggling to get. But Nabulina, the central bank governor, I mean, she said last year to Russian companies, you have to be prepared to trade down two generations of technology.
Yes.
Because some things are going to be very difficult to find. I mean, most things, So they need microchips in order to build the high-precision, you know, guided missiles. But the chips you need for that, you can get from a washing machine.
Yeah.
So suddenly Kyrgyzstan has become a massive importer of washing machines to Russia, which they're stripping to make missiles. But, you know, the really, really sophisticated stuff, there's a much better control on that. Oil and gas, you know, LNG, some of the sophisticated oil and gas machinery technology has become difficult to get. But it's wounded the economy, but it hasn't collapsed it anyway in the way that they hoped that it would.
So the oil and gas revenues are still generating, you know, hefty profits, right? Because the price has gone down on both oil and gas. But I would
not
have
really.
Thought that not too much, I guess. Yeah. Well, can you explain that? Can you flesh that out a little?
There's a confusion here because there's a blend, the Russian blend. I mean, so the benchmark blend is the Brent oil.
Right.
And the Russian blend is Urals. It's a sort of sour, sulfur high content.
So it's not as pure and it needs more refining? Is that so
well,
it's cheaper?
Yeah. Before the war, it had a $2 discount to Brent. So if Brent was like 80, then Urals would be 78.
I see.
But the thing with the Brent, with the Urals price, which has collapsed, and you know the discount blew out to like $35.
Right.
But the Brent oil, the Urals oil, is the oil that's sent from Siberia to the Gulf of Finland and then is shipped down the coast to Rotterdam. And with the self-sanctioning that went on, the volume of that oil has collapsed. There's no oil being sent. There's a few people in the market that are still buying it. Because the bulk of the oil has now been shipped from Russia to Asia, to China and India. Right. And so the Urals price is very specifically on this European route. And it's no longer representative because the oil that they're selling to India and China is the same price as the international price, and even at a premium in some cases. So there was a point where Urals prices had collapsed to $35 a barrel, at a time when Brent was over 50, but Russia was still selling to India and China and getting $75, $80 a barrel for it.
Why? How are they able to do that? Because I thought the talk was that the Indians, for example, were able basically had, you know, Russia by the throat or something, because it's like, look, you either sell it for zero to nobody or you sell it to us for this massive discount. That's just not true then, I guess, huh?
No, it's not, because, I mean, they're in competition with other oil. You know, the Indians, the Chinese are importing. I mean, before the war, the Chinese made sure that they never imported more than 15% of their oil from any one country. And so when the Russians are pricing the oil, they have to offer a discount. And in the first months, they offered a hefty discount. But then the market just kicks in and does its thing. And the Russians then say, look, you're buying from Saudi at $80, so we'll sell it to you at $79. And the Chinese are like, right, that's a better deal, so we'll do that. And the market's just kicked in and done its thing. And the entire 2 million barrels a day that Russia exports that used to go to Europe has just been rerouted, and now it's going to Asia. And Asia, of course, India, China, both are not complying with sanctions. They haven't joined the sanctions scheme. Mm-hmm. And so Russians are able to sell it at the international price to Asia. And moreover, the appetite there has been enough to absorb the entire export volume that used to go to Europe now goes to Asia. The entire volume.
That's amazing.
I remember a lot of sort of smug stories that implied it would be impossible for Russia or China to make the links to manage that new direction for Russian oil in under certain number
There's
of years.
There's another surprise. Yeah, I mean, what they did in the space of 6 months is they massively increased the tanker fleet that they have five, 600 ships, which is enough volume to carry the entire export volume by tanker. The difference is that the Rotterdam, Gulf of Finland to Rotterdam trip used to take like a week, 10 days, and now it takes 2 months to get the oil there. So their transport costs have gone up. So the cost of Russia has gone up. But then they've done deals with the Asians whereby they're handing a lot of those transport costs to the Asian, you know, the end buyers having to pay them. So there's still, you know, unhealthy profits. And the crude business is incredibly fast, entirely switched from Europe to Asia. No one was expecting that to happen. And because India and China are not signed up to the sanction scheme, they continue to sell oil at the international prices. But the complicating factor is that in February, the oil products sanctions kicked in. And that's slightly different because Russia also is a big refiner and is selling gasoline and naphtha and kerosene as well. But to get the international market to absorb that, and the volumes there are even bigger than the crude, because obviously if you refine it, it's worth more money. Right. But now Russia is competing against its own crude refined products, in so much as, you know, all the crude that they're sending to India and China is being refined, which makes it harder for Russia to sell its own gasoline, diesel, naphtha, kerosene on the international markets. So, but that's working too. I mean, the oil trade is saying the adjustment there is going slower. And there's a lot of Russian refined products floating around in ships looking for customers at the moment. But that only started in February and it's going to take several months. But, you know, with crude, it took several months for the market to rebalance. And everyone's expecting the market to do its thing again. And that there'll be customers found for this oil. It's just a question of, like, how long you want to wait, how big a discount are you willing to offer, how desperate are you for the cash, but it'll get sold. So as I say, the whole, you know, oil price cap sanctions, oil sanctions really have not worked well at all. And Russia has plenty of money as a result.
Two quick questions about this. The first one, a shorter one, I guess. What about insuring, you know, a big sort of vulnerability was supposed to be insurance on tankers. And if the U.S. could cut that off, or the, you know, G7, whatever, then there was no way that any tanker would ship Russian oil. And there's a way, I know that there's some kind of ways around that. And then the second question is about natural gas, LNG. Like, how are they selling that?
Right. So on the insurance thing, you're right. I mean, the enforcement mechanism for the oil price cap, you know, you're allowed to buy Russian oil directly from Russia if it costs less than $60 a barrel. And the way they were going to enforce that was to withdraw insurance from any ship that took on oil that was more expensive than that. And the idea was that Lloyd's of London controls 95% of the world's shipping insurance. But then the West overestimated, you know, their power here, in so much as they thought, oh, well, this 5% is insignificant. But it turns out it's not insignificant. Moreover, the Russians have, you know, through Roskostrach, the Russian insurance agency, they've insured their own ships. And then all the people who are not complying with sanctions, they're like, fine, you've got insurance. And the Central Bank of Russia, you know, capitalized it to the tune of several billion dollars so that the insurance is adequate. The Indians, who were also part of this international insurance club, they also refused to join the sanctions and have insured Russian ships so that they have a valid insurance by an Indian insurer. And so this 500 tankers that they have got insurance, which is acceptable for two-thirds of the world. And if you go into Europe, you can even insure a Russian, you know, a Greek ship. It's the Greeks carrying a lot of Russian oil. Right. Half of the Russian oil is carried by Greek ships. And they're insured by Lloyd's. And as long as the nominal contract price is less than $60, then that's fine. And Lloyd's will insure it. And there's games being played there because it has to do with, you know, free on board price as opposed to the final delivery price, so that you can do a $59 contract free on board, but then once you add in the transport costs, which are separate, and then it goes up suddenly to $75. And, you know, it's just a piece of Swiss cheese full of holes. And again, the West is playing whack-a-mole. It's trying to catch up with all these schemes. And the Russians, I mean, the Russians, you know, Russian mafia, financial scams, you know, shell companies, they're really good at this. They really know what to do. Yeah. It's one of their strong points.
Yeah. And what about natural gas / LNG?
So the LNG, several things there. So last year, China was on lockdown and it wasn't using all the LNG that it signed up to do. And so what the Russians were doing on paper was selling the LNG to China, who was then on paper selling the LNG to Europe. However, the actual ships just went from the Gulf of Finland to Rotterdam. Because it's a swap. You know? Yeah. And so just on paper, it was actually coming from China. And the other problem with LNG is that it's a very young industry. And because Asia, countries like Japan are almost entirely dependent on LNG, there's not enough. There's not enough to feed everybody. I mean, to feed Europe with all the LNG, plus Japan, plus the other Asian countries are buying it. So you are forced to buy Russian LNG. And there's still a question mark that the insufficient supplies to... Now you've ditched this 150 billion cubic meters, BCM, of Russian piped gas to Europe. Last year, they managed to import 130 BCM of LNG. But this year now, China's economy has recovered and is open again. There's a question as to whether that's going to be possible. And there's no new production is due for another 2 years. There's a huge field in Qatar that could make up the shortfall. But the Qataris are saying, but we want you to sign up to long-term 5-10-year contracts. And in Europe, they don't want to do that because they're in the middle of the green revolution. They're supposed to be phasing all these fossil fuels out. So you're sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place. And, you know, everyone's trying to work out how to make this work. And in the meantime, and this is another crazy thing with this war, in the meantime, Russia is still delivering piped gas to Europe through Ukraine. And Naftogaz, the Ukrainian company, is paying, is receiving transit fees from Gazprom to pass this gas. So the Russians are paying the Ukrainians to transit this gas, which the Ukrainians are taking that money and pouring it into their war machine.
Yeah.
And at the same token, Gazprom is earning money from Europe for delivering this gas, which is pouring into its war machine.
What about the costs of not using Russian energy for Europe versus the advantage of using Russian energy for India and China? Has that made any difference in the graphs of those two regions' economies?
Well, yeah, we mentioned this last time. And what this whole sanctions scheme has done is introduced massive distortions into the market. So ironically, a lot of the diesel that Europe's buying, which it used to buy from Russia, it's now buying from India. The difference being is that still Russian oil, except now you've got to ship the crude halfway around the world and then ship it back to Europe halfway around the world with very heavy transport costs. Mm-hmm. And who's paying those costs? It's the European consumer because all the prices have gone up. Right. Whereas it's the same Russian oil that you would bought before. It's just now a lot more expensive and a lot more difficult to organize getting it. So the costs have gone up for everyone, and that's eaten into the Russian margin. But then, you know, the result is here in Europe that we've got like horrific inflation. You know, Central European countries, they're all running at 20% a year. And on top of that, you've got food inflation, which again is related to the grain deliveries, because again, Ukraine and Russia are responsible for a third of the world's traded grain. So those prices have gone up again. And we're just seeing it now. I mean, just this week, prices fell at the gas prices fell to a low of about $280 at the start of this year because we got through the winter, the tanks were full, the winter was mild, and suddenly everyone, the panic was over. Yep. But the prices have just gone up to $500 and today they went to $550. So they've doubled. Because we're now starting to move towards the next heating season and that the tanks need to be refilled. And again, there's not quite enough gas because the tanks, the volume of the storage tanks in Europe is always finely judged in so much as there's enough to... What happens is you have a surplus in the summer so that you use the surplus to fill the tanks. And in the winter, you have a deficit, but the tanks are only big enough to hold the deficit, assuming the Russian gas continues to be piped. And what's gone out of the equation is that pipe gas is no longer there. And the tanks themselves are not big enough to provide gas for the Europe for the whole winter without imports of some sort. And so you've got pressure on the LNG supplies. You've got the Russian pipe gas no longer coming through Nord Stream that was blown up in the Baltic last September. And this is why the prices are creeping up. So it looks like, you know, we're going to have another energy crisis with spiking prices. It's not going to be nearly as bad as last year because people have, you know, invested into green and the Germans have built some LNG terminals and la, la, la. So there's been a lot of preparation. But we've already seen the prices double in the last 2 months.
Right. I saw
and
that.
That's, Yeah. So, you know, it's an ongoing problem. And Europe spent $600-700 billion on subsidies.
Yes, I know. That's
year.
Crazy. Yeah. And almost $1 trillion on subsidizing the loss of cheap energy. Yeah.
No, and here, you know, at home, I mean, the prices went up 20-fold. But our gas bill, we normally pay about 400 euros a quarter, but we got a surcharge at the end of last year for 400 plus 1,400 euros surcharge, just out of the blue to pay for this extra. I don't know, the economic cost, I mean, people, you know, it's weighing on the European economies. And look, talking about the economic war, I mean, one statistic that sort of shows how badly it's going is that Russia is expected to, its economy is expected to grow this year by about 1.5-2%. But Germany has gone into recession.
Yeah.
And so has the UK. And most of Europe are looking at about 1%. And the World Bank, just the global outlook, you know, has again reduced global growth to about 2.8. You know, these are all very bad, soggy figures. And so it's costing. I mean, you could argue that actually the sanctions have actually done more damage to the European economies than they have to Russia, in so much as they put two of the major economies into recession already. So this is what you're alluding to when you're saying people are, like, you know, not happy with the way it's going and starting to get cold feet.
So is Germany still, you know, being the sort of the manufacturing industrial powerhouse engine of Europe, and that whole structure dependent on long-term, knowably long-term cheap Russian gas, that gone? It's going into recession, but it also hasn't collapsed, or has it? Or is that because of this nearly $1 trillion worth of subsidies to make up for the shortfall? Like,
well, you know, Europe has the money. Germany has the money to pay this.
Yeah,
it can afford it. It's extremely rich, and moreover, the financial leverage that Europe in general and Germany in particular can master, again, come up with the money. You just kick it down the road, you know, to future generations. It's not a problem. As to what extent the German model is broken, because it was importing a lot of extremely cheap piped gas, and it was making, you know, low energy costs plus extremely high quality widgets that it was selling at a premium and exporting all over the world. And that model works extremely well. And now the energy prices have gone up, and so that whole equation has been altered. Whether it's going to break the German model remains an open question. There's also the issue of deindustrialization.
Yes.
So Germany's had to close down its fertilizer plants, it's closed down its metal plants, its steel plants, car sectors affected because the prices have gone up. And
BASF has been hurting, right? I mean, I don't
BASF
know if it's hurting.
They've shut like 100 factories across, chemical factories across Europe. You know, they're in serious trouble because this cheap Russian gas is gone. And so none of that stuff is viable, which ironically makes you more dependent on Russia because it's the world's biggest producer of all of these gas-based chemicals. Fertilizer is all coming from Russia, and it still has to, and has not been sanctioned as a result. But I think it's temporary because the gas is gone and it won't come back. But Germany needs to complete its green revolution and accelerate its investment into green energy. And then it could, in theory, replace the gas with green energy, and that's becoming cheaper and cheaper. Mm-hmm. But it's extremely painful. So no, Germany's not going to collapse. It's going to continue being a rich country because, you know, at the end of the day, they're very organized. Mm-hmm. And they'll make this transition. And they can raise the funding for it. But it's going to weigh. It's going to be a debt burden. It's going to take time. It's a process of bringing those green prices down. They're falling, but they're going to. But I don't know. Green, there's another irony there. It's like China dominates the supply of solar panels.
And not just solar panels. I mean, lithium refining. They have a lot of cobalt refining. All the refining that goes into all the green, like, battery stuff, it's all massively controlled, I know, by China. And the U.S. is trying to push Germany and other EU allies to I don't know, start a slow kind of economic war with China. It's kind of weird.
I was reading, yeah. I mean, with the solar technology, that the Chinese are not just doing it cheaply. Their technology and manufacturing technology is vastly superior to Europe, so that even if Germany decides, like, we're going to replace the gas with solar, they can't do it without China's help, because China can undercut them, because their technology, their solar technology is so much more superior, that the efficiency of their factories is so much more superior. So I was talking to some German academic friends of mine, and they were like, you know, we've missed a trick here. We've been left behind, and we're severely behind now. And to catch up, it's going to take at least a decade of massive investment.
Wow.
So this whole war is like, you know, because it's realigned all of the trade relations, and the ones we had before, comparative advantage, buying cheap and high quality solar tech from the Chinese, buying cheap and high quality agricultural chemicals from the Russians, and suddenly now everyone's being forced back on themselves and suddenly realizing, like, we don't make this, or if we do, we make it really badly. And suddenly our input costs have gone up. And so, you know, again, I think this is something that's pushing people slowly to try and bring the war to the end. I mean, I can tell you the German industry are howling at the door of the Chancellor. Stop this. This is
really okay. That's interesting. Yeah, and I think Italy is the same. I think a few of the big countries really want this war to end. But, you know, industry has not been in charge, which is always, which was just one of the big surprises of the last couple of years, is the national security states in Washington particularly, and then even in Europe, got trumped the business interest. That was surprising, probably surprised to Putin as well in his calculations. Quick question though, since you are in Germany, how is the German public? So now we're like, what, 4 months after Hirsch's big bombshell saying that, arguing that that the CIA, the US blew up Nord Stream. And then since then, everything was mum and gosh, we don't know. And after that, suddenly it's like, oh, wow, it turns out the CIA knew 3 months in advance. And dang it, tried to warn the Ukrainians, but they just done it without listening to us and blaming Ukraine or blaming Poland. But in any event, everybody pretty much agrees at this point that if it wasn't the U.S., it was one of the countries that the U.S. funds and arms, whether it's, you know, Ukraine or Poland. And meanwhile, there's Germany. This was critical energy infrastructure. It could always be repaired, but, like, I mean, this is an act of war. It's bizarre to me. Is there anger there? Is there any political fallout? Like, I've seen, for example, the AfD, that extreme right party, its poll numbers have doubled in the last 6 months. And whereas the ruling party's poll numbers have really started after an initial big bump, have fallen a lot. So are people freaking out? What do they think? And is it going to have political consequences?
No, I think this is Zelensky's nightmare. I think it's been clear from the beginning that, you know, at some point the Ukraine fatigue is going to set in. And what we're seeing, AfD, they're just about to overtake the Greens and become the second biggest party, which is a bit of a shake-up, a shock for the Germans.
Yeah.
Because the Greens kind of lost the plot. Baerbock, who's the foreign minister and also the Green Party leader, I mean, she's been extremely aggressive.
Very hawkish, very NATO hawkish, right? Yeah.
I mean, she did things. She went on telly here in a talk show and said, like, we're going to pursue this war to the end. We're going to stand with Ukraine to the bitter end, even if it costs us, you know, our arm and a leg. And even if there's mass demonstrations against it, I'm going to ignore them. And this being Germany, everyone was like, this is a democracy.
Yeah.
And you are our elected leader. And if we, the people, don't want it, then you have to do that. So to say something like that was very arrogant.
It's also bizarre from a green. I mean, the founders came out of the 68, out of demonstrations, right? Anti-war demonstrations. So
68,
it's like,
right?
Yeah, it's pretty bizarre.
With her, I mean, sort of widely believed that she's got political ambitions and that she wants to be chancellor, and so she's taking a hard line. And ironically, long history, 20 years of Russia, the Western politicians have always believed that if you're very hawkish on Russia, you look strong in what they think is a binary proposal. And it comes at no political cost to you, which has been the mistake, because here we are at war with Russia when we shouldn't have been, because Putin, having followed him closely for like 2 decades, he's reached out several times to Europe and said, like, I want to be partners. And I have this security concern over NATO and Ukraine. And he was ignored and demonized. And it's also fed into the misunderstanding, because this economic war that's not going well, if you ask me, is predicated on the fact that Russia's always been seen as a petrol station with nuclear bombs. Yep. That's how it is. It's been belittled. Yep.
They're and primitive actually, is the idea. They're brutes. They're primitive. Yeah. And they just happen to have nukes and everything else is a joke.
All we need to do is confiscate their houses in Nice, ban a few oligarchs, and turn off the money spigot by taking them out of SWIFT, and they'll collapse. Yeah. And actually, because we've got at the moment SPIEF, the S&P Economic Conference, and I was just watching the economic panel today with all the top guys, and Nabulina from the central bank, and Zelyanov, the finance minister. And they were doing, you know, 1 year on, and they were almost jolly. They were like, well, that's all gone a lot better than we were expecting. And, you know, last year, Nabulina was predicting a global crisis and a collapse in Russia and a banking crisis. And today she was saying, no, actually, you know, we think growth, we've upgraded our growth forecast, and actually now we're thinking it's at the top end of the range, around 2%. And we've been amazed at how resilient Russian companies have been, and that instead of like sacking people and closing down production, what they've done is they've thrown investment into their businesses to retool and find new suppliers and get rid of the stuff that they can't get from the West anymore. And industrial production has just gone back into the black. PMI manufacturing index, it's like 4 months, extremely strong. Optimism, outlook on sales. And, you know, all the railways going to the Far East are clogged up because there's so much business going in that direction now. And they were like, yeah, we just have like a whole bunch of practical problems to deal with. And, you know, we can continue our global integration. It's just, you know, we're not going to sell to Europe anymore. So, you know, I don't say it's going to backfire, but ironically, this whole thing of petrol station with nuclear bombs is just not true. That we have a lot of very confident and competent Russian businesses who've just done the market thing, and they have funds. Corporate lending has gone up. The banking sector had one of its best first quarters in years because of profits and lending. Interest rates are coming down. Inflation's down. Low unemployment. Real incomes have gone up, been fed and accelerated by the falling interest. So consumption is strong to the point where Nabulina says, like, I'm worried now about the economy overheating.
Underestimating Russia has never been a good strategy, you know. But go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just wondering, as a naive consumer of movies where the computer knows everything and can predict everything, was it possible for the people who matter in NATO and in Europe and in the U.S. to predict that any of this would happen? Did they anticipate this?
They definitely did. Well, you answer. I think they definitely did not. I
don't know. Mark knows my work. I've been arguing for years that Russia's been underestimated. But it's actually much more efficient and productive. And the companies, I mean, because the thing is, it's a function. It started back in around 2003. With the Khodorkovsky affair, this oligarch that got jailed, and everyone turned on Russia and Putin at the same time. And then there's been this industry of demonizing it, of caricature, you know, making a caricature out of it. Whereas, you know, what my publication does, we're interested in like modern Russia and all the non-politicized companies. And when you read the international coverage, they focus on the political sectors, you know, the oil and gas, Gazprom, everybody knows, Rosneft, everybody knows. But then Ozon, the you know, the e-commerce site, or I don't know, there's like dozens of like world class, Yandex, Periodchka, X5, fantastic supermarket, you know, cutting edge technology they have in the supermarket business, and then the sudden advent of discount stores and so on and so forth. IKEA started used to buy all of its products that it sold in Moscow in the IKEA store from China. But in the last 4 years, it's switched to domestic sources. And so suddenly we've had all this light industry that never was there before, making toys and buckets and mops and, you know, sort of garden furniture and what have you. And it's because of this one-sided stereotype of reporting, it left the West totally unprepared.
That's such a great point, Ben. I want to emphasize that again, that it's, and it's not just the media, but it's cultural. It's the cultural stereotypes as well that is very much informed political stereotypes or political elite stereotypes, which then reinforce the cultural stereotypes, which is that Russians can't actually do anything. And this is deeply ingrained, that they're barbaric. They, you know, they just happen to have nukes, and the rest they are either oligarchs who are these crude thieves and criminals. Well, a lot more criminals, but I'm saying like that represents Russians, either oligarchs or this, you know, this evil Bond villain dictator, or masses of people who don't have toilets, have never seen a washing machine. Like, this is the idea in people's heads who have not actually been to Russia. And it makes you miscalculate what's going to happen, right, when that's so deeply ingrained.
The oligarch sanctions are a really good point. I mean, yes, a lot of those oligarchs were connected, have paid bribes, twisted, whatever, made their money, you know, through, quote-unquote, being close to Putin. However, the bulk of them, and I've met a lot of oligarchs, and particularly the new batch, the ones didn't come out of the 90s, they're just brilliant businessmen sitting in a giant market, that by far the biggest consumer market in Europe. And they just did sensible things, like set up a supermarket chain, or like telecom overlay, or like computer, you know, whatever, Yandex, most valuable tech company in all of Europe. And they didn't do anything wrong. They were out Googling Google. But the thing is with the oligarch sanctions is that it's simply, if you're rich, the argument goes that you cannot make money in Russia without being close to the government and being corrupt. And it's simply not true. And so we got involved in an investigation with some oligarchs, you know, who got sanctioned, and then turned out that the sanctions in the EU were based on an article in The Guardian alleging that they'd been, you know, had some Swiss bank accounts. Whereas when we dug into it, it turned out it's just a normal corporate structure, and the money was there because the guy happened to own the biggest iron plant in all of Europe, and he exports to Europe legally because iron ore hadn't been sanctioned. And they ended up having to withdraw the sanctions. But, you know, it took him a year in court. And the irony is when these oligarchs go to court and actually are entitled to due process, that then when the court looks at the evidence, they're like, there is no evidence. You just had this sort of fairly shabby article in The Guardian, and you got put on the sanctions list for that. Because the whole mentality... he contributes, yes. Yeah. But it's the mentality of it is they're guilty until proven innocent.
Yeah.
And this is another thing that's being undermined in this war is like, you know, innocent until proven guilty is the bedrock of our legal system. And we've just suspended that and turned it on its head with this whole sanctions regime because it's knee-jerk. And again, it's the politicians like... I call it, you know, must be seen to do something-ism, that you can't do nothing.
Yes,
you have to act.
Yeah. And the sanctions that's one of the worst things is the do something-ism. That's what got us into Iraq, you know, and a lot of into Libya, you know, that helped fuel the Libya. We must do something. No, actually, you don't have to do something if it's stupid. But yeah, even the idea that we call Russia's rich and billionaires oligarchs is such a misnomer because oligarchs have ultimate political control over the politicians by definition. And by definition in Russia, I mean, Putin jailed the ones who tried to, you know, or expelled those who tried to exert political control over him. So the political class, starting with Putin, the Kremlin, has control. I mean, you could say that there, you know, that he could take away their wealth, or you know that their wealth in some cases depends on their connections, but they're kind of the opposite of oligarchs. Yeah, but they're kind of the opposite of oligarchs. They don't have political control. That's the whole thing. So it's kind of ridiculous.
They have none. I mean, there's this phrase that Belton and Harding and all these journalists who've made a career out of slamming Russia, close to Putin, which is totally meaningless. And, I mean, look, an excellent example is a guy called Oleg Tinkov. He set up Russia's first ever purely online bank. And it was an enormous
and the brewery,
success.
Right? The microbrewery.
Yeah, he's a serial entrepreneur. So he made a fortune like doing beer. And I had a really excellent bar in St. Petersburg, which unfortunately isn't there anymore. And then he took his beer money and set up a bunch of companies. One of them was this online bank. And it was the first pure online bank, which, because it had no bricks and mortar branches, the margins were just insanely profitable. And the bank was a runaway success. But Tinkoff, who is a real kooky character, he came out and he said, I condemn this war. We shouldn't be in there. Like, Putin's a fascist. And talking to people around him who I know, they were telling him, Alec, for God's sake, don't say a word.
Yeah.
And he was biting his tongue, and then went online and just out and out condemned the war.
Yeah.
And so what happened? He lost his bank. They threatened him with jail, and he's now living in a nice villa in Mexico, having lost this bank, which was worth billions of dollars. It just got taken away from him. So, you know, you don't mess. But he has been sanctioned.
Because
he's rich.
Really? Wow. Yeah. He's an oligarch, you know. Look at that oligarch controlling Putin there, you know.
Because he's worth a couple of billion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he's
well, the idea of the sanctions on the so-called oligarchs, on Russia's rich, is the idea that sanctions, I mean, the initial idea, which is also stupid, was that if we sanction them, they're going to be so incentivized to overthrow Putin. I remember all kinds of even intelligent people in the first month or two saying, they're going to overthrow him. They're going to overthrow him. Like, are you out of your freaking mind? No, they're not. Like, how stupid are you? And then it becomes, well, they're already sanctioned. Sanctions almost never get pulled. Once they're in, who's going to argue to pull the sanctions, you know? So, like...
Well, I think there was a lot of unreflective mirror imaging there. Like, if a country like the U.S., particularly the U.S., made life uncomfortable, took all the yachts away, and I always remember that seized yacht in the harbor when I was last in Trieste. If you did that to the American elite, they would overthrow the government.
Yes.
Nobody was willing to say that, but that's the implication. Yeah. And they might not have thought that things might be different.
It's true.
I can think that the analogy I would draw here is like, you know, the initial sanctions which targeted and froze the central banks $300 billion and stopping banning Russia banks from SWIFT. These are like HIMARS. These are highly accurate, highly effective, highly destructive sanctions that really make a difference. But we've gone beyond that because the trouble is that you've taken out a few valuable targets, and they haven't ended the economic war. They haven't brought Russia to its knees. And so we've progressively moved on because of this need to do something-ism. We've progressively gone on, and now we're firing, like, you know, the dumb artillery shells just to wound and smash Russia up. And that, this campaign against oligarchs, because they're obviously rich, and it's so easy because of the, you know, reporting for the last 20 years to argue that they're all connected to the government, and this is going to foment revolution around Putin by the people he quote-unquote relies on, which he does not at all, that we just take them out and we're just like firing shells at anybody. So someone like Tinkoff, you know, who shouldn't have been sanctioned at all, is actually on our side, ends up, you know, being collateral damage. So it's not thought through, and we're now at a very difficult stage whereby sanctions aren't really working, Russia's adapting, the economy is adapting very fast, even faster. Nabulina and Silyanov at the conference today, they were both saying that we were caught out. We didn't think our companies, they called it accelerated adaptivity, that they hadn't been expecting their companies to be so fast and so quick to retool, to rebuild their businesses, and that how strong and robust the main bulk of the economy has turned out to be. So this is why they were so jolly. It's like, you know, we've got lots of real problems. And the economy's not doing as well as it should do, but it's doing well enough. You know, we're not going to be defeated through sanctions. This is not going to make a difference to the end of the war. It's not going to bring the end of the war closer.
Yeah, let's go back to the war now, if we can.
Good transition there. I wish that siren of the cop siren that you had in the background there, Ben, that was so authentic. I wish we had it right at that point when we make this transition. but anyway, that's great. Well, let's talk about, because, you know, over the last week, All the articles have been, well, actually, it's been somewhat muted, but that the counteroffensive has been launched. I mean, certainly, at the very least, you could say the first phase of the counteroffensive is underway. And Ben, you just wrote up a piece on Beanie and Telenews, which for viewers who haven't heard Ben's previous ones, or listeners who are new, it's a great business publication based out of Berlin that covers a lot of Soviet Union.
We have reporters in all these countries, including a couple in Ukraine, bne.eu. So, I mean, that was exactly our line. You know, my correspondent in Kiev rang me and said, look, the counteroffensive started. And so we were looking at the reports and I'm like, no, it hasn't. What we're definitely seeing the Ukrainians go on the offensive. And that's new. And they're obviously probing the line all the way, you know, from Belarus border down to the Black Sea. And there are attacks going on in all sorts of places, in Zaporizhzhia, around Kherson. And they're looking for weaknesses because the main force has not been thrown into the battle yet. And Ukraine has some like 12 brigades, some newly formed brigades, young guys have been training in Germany for several months. They've been given a whole bunch of new kits that NATO Poland have been reporting anything between 250 and 500 tanks have been sent to Ukraine, including some 40 Leopards, maybe more. Suddenly the reporting on the delivery of Leopards, these German-made ultra-high modern tanks, that's dried up. A lot of rockets, 200,000 shells have been delivered. But then if you look at the battlefield reporting, none of that stuff is showing up. Everyone's still fighting with the old Soviet, you know, era Buchs missiles and Kalashnikovs. And, you know, they've lost all their night goggles. They've been on veterans who got killed. And so it's still very basic. So what clearly seems to me, anyway, my read, is that Ukraine has been stockpiling this. They have a large force, assault force, in preparation. And what they're doing now is probing the line, trying to find weaknesses. Because, again, a lot of the reports in the first days were like, you know, Ukraine's attacked, you know, broke through in some places, didn't get so far in others, but then quickly retreated in order to preserve material and men. And it's also a shaping thing, whereby if you attack one part of the line, you draw reinforcements to it, which creates a weakness elsewhere. And you can be certain, absolutely sure, that Ukraine has fantastic intel. The Americans have made the whole satellite technology and everything available to them. So they can see exactly how these attacks are pulling Russian resources around. But against that, the New York Times actually, unusually, did a really good piece on the Russian defenses, because they had, I mean, the last knockback was in Kharkiv and Kherson in September, and they spent eight months digging in, and very sophisticated, it seems, that the Russians have lightly defended first line, which are basically a tripwire line, so that when you get attacked, then command gets to know about it before the Ukrainians can get too far. And then behind that line is a field of mines and these dragon teeth and tank traps and tank ditches. And then there's another set of trenches behind that, much deeper, much more sophisticated, much better defended. So the problem for Ukraine is to find a weakness where they can smash through. But then given that the Russians have been building for 8 months, very effectively and very concertedly, that, you know, it remains to be seen if there is a weakness. Because when they had this spectacular campaign in September, again, Ukraine high commands, who are actually much better at this than the Russians seem to be, but they made a feint towards Kherson, and then the Russians put 20 battle groups into Kherson to defend it, but then pulled troops from Kharkiv in the Donbass in order to reinforce Kherson. And then instead of hitting Kherson, the Ukrainians hit the Kharkiv line, which was weak and thinly defended, smashed through, routed the army, took back hundreds of kilometers of territory, a huge success. And then, of course, by the end of the month, they took Kherson as well by blowing up the bridges. So it became impossible to supply. And Kiev needs a success like that again. But I think because Ukraine has gone on the offensive. So they've been doing spectacularly well, but you have to remember that they've been defensive until now. Yeah. And in the offense, typically, I'm not a military analyst, but I read that typically you need 5-1 manpower.
Certainly
advantage.
Minimum 3-1, yeah.
3-1, whatever yeah. it is. But anyway, it
yeah,
means
well,
that...
Yeah, well, it varies. And
yeah.
there have been times when defense dominated or offense dominated, and military forces are often slow to see that change. But it does seem like at this point in this war, defense does dominate.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, the Russian casualty figures, I mean, gleefully reported how high they are, 200,000, you know, at least 2-1 to the Ukrainians. But the Russians have been on the offense this whole time. And now if you're going to turn the tables, it'll be the Ukrainians' turn to die in large numbers. Yeah. Having said all of that, the hope is that they've been given these very sophisticated, powerful weapons that if they can deliver a hammer blow and smash through, I mean, maybe the tanks can drive over these sophisticated defenses easily. And if you get behind the lines and rout them, because the Ukraine's best hope is that the morale and discipline on the in the Russian army is so low, you could trigger a catastrophic collapse in morale. And then
do you think it's that low? I mean, or that you're saying that's the hope, because I don't buy that. I don't believe it's that low. Even when it's been low, it's not as low as people think. I mean, we've gone back through different wars, including the Chechen War, which is a low point. Yeah. And it's never quite like people think it is, I don't think.
Of course not. No, look, it's impossible to say because, you know, all the information we're getting from the Ukrainian side is coming via Bankova. It's extremely controlled. We just accredited a new guy there, and he has to go through this whole palaver of registering. And then there's like yellow zones and red zones. There's places you can go. There's places you're not allowed to go. And coming out of the Russian side is virtually nothing information-wise. Mm-hmm. There's some stuff on the Telegram channels.
Exactly.
But there's
military bloggers. It's sort of like pro-Russian military bloggers. And then you have to sift through. You know, they do tell a lot of truth. You get a lot more info lately out of them than the Ukrainian, pro-Ukrainian sort of social media. But they also, you know, their biases are so obvious that you just have to verify everything.
Putin just met with them, and I was actually watching. There was a group of them sat at the table, and I recognized Sasha, is a guy I know from Russia Today, was one of their most outspoken propaganda talking heads. And there he was sitting in front of Putin. And Sasha's whole job has been to sell, you know, the RT line. He's very good at it.
Sasha, what's his last name?
Oh, I forget.
Not
you'd recognize him. He's got a bald head and big beard. And he was always on spouting off about this and that. But yeah, it's impossible to say. I agree with you. I don't get the impression that morale is low enough that the line will collapse and everyone will just run and turn their guns. I mean, the Chechen War was interesting because, I mean, that the fight in Grozny did go bad. And Lebedev, the general, he said at one point he thought 1 in 3 of soldiers wanted to go home and 1 in 10 were prepared to shoot their officers.
He had some great lines, Lebedev.
He did.
Yeah. There is this talk, though, that Ukraine really needs to Franz Stefan Gatti, he's one of the more popular kind of NATO land military analysts and foreign policy, had this big piece, I don't know, like a month or so ago about the coming counteroffensive. And the first 24 hours are decisive. And it's all about, going through, of course, they're going to always cite World War II battles, that the first 24 hours are decisive. But even some really good analysts on the NATO side have also, I mean, this is definitely NATO thinking. I don't know if it's Ukraine thinking, but it's definitely NATO thinking that the beginning of the counteroffensive is going to shape everything. And if that's the case, first of all, I think that's a recipe most likely, but I don't want to predict anything, but most likely for disaster. That puts an impossibly high bar on the Ukrainians, I would think, because it's going to be real. Like, last year when Ukraine had its successes, Russia, as you said, was still in offensive mode. Tactically, it was doing defense in the big Kherson battles in the south in August of last year, but it was still very much in offensive mode and also thin. And now, you know, they've mobilized and strategically since Surovikin came in last year, they have strategically turned much more to defense, obviously. And they've created
shortened the lines
and just massive defensive works. And Ukraine has not faced that, you know, and neither has NATO for that matter. Neither has the U.S. hasn't faced something like this, you know, since World War II. Nobody has. And so the expectations on Ukraine are really high.
Yeah. And I think those expectations have always been a factor in decisions by the Ukrainian military. Yeah. You could tell before their offensive toward Kharkiv that there was pressure on them to do something. Yes. And
I just wrote a blog, and it seems to me, and again, speculative, but I think Ukraine or Zelensky's been forced into a position where he's taking a huge gamble.
Yes.
Because his whole strategy here has been to keep this in the top of the headlines.
Yeah.
Because he needs that, because he needs the money and he needs the material. And everybody has been, you know, he's a hero. I mean, he's really a sort of Marvel real-life hero. He's done a fantastic job with his PR. He's done a fantastic... The Ukrainian fighters, absolute heroes. They've done an amazing job at fighting this brutal Russian war machine. However, with this counteroffensive, they've stacked up a lot of resources as far as I can see. And they're going to throw them at the line and they need to break through. But if it goes badly, if he runs into a brick wall, if they suddenly start having, lots of cargo 200, you know, dead from the field coming back, and that it's not going anywhere, then because there's an unspoken policy here. I mean, there's all these disjointed comments coming out of the White House, but Jens Stoltenberg said it again yesterday with Blinken at a NATO meeting, that the Ukrainians, we're going to do everything to empower them in order for them to smash through, to take back as much territory as possible, so that when they go to the negotiating table, they have the strongest position they can. But to me, that concedes what I think everybody realizes is that Ukraine can't win this war. They can't. Mm-hmm. The stated goal is to eject Russia entirely from their territory, including the Crimea. And it's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And this comment by Stoltenberg, and I've heard it from the State Department a couple of times, is actually they want to put on the back foot so that then they're going to concede that they can't win and go to the negotiating table and give Putin as much problems headache as they can in order to get the best possible deal. But then that has to include conceding territory. That has to include freezing the fight. Crimea, they're not going to get. The Russians would never give that up anyway. Putin can't give that up because that really would cause a revolution in Russia. It's one of the few things that would. But Donbass would be frozen. You know, you end up with the Chinese peace plan where you have a demilitarized zone and you have like a North Korea type situation where, you know, nobody agrees. There's agreed to stop shooting each other.
Right. Ceasefire, but not peace deal, basically. Yeah. I would generally agree with you, although one thing we've learned from this war, you know, Ukraine, graveyard of predictions, wars are anyway by their nature so incredibly unpredictable. There are always political considerations that may make something that seems totally rational and logical impossible. Like, I mean, can Zelensky actually cut a ceasefire and not get assassinated? For example,
do you want to hear an interesting piece of Moscow gossip that I've heard recently?
Sure.
Is that there's chatter in Moscow that Putin won't stand for re-election next year because there's presidential elections and that he'll actually step down and that somebody else, a bit more conciliatory, will be put in charge, like the governor of the Moscow Oblast. Someone, because everyone's desperate to see the end of the war, then if you have someone who's not like a hardliner, like Patrushev, the former FSB head, you know, who really is a hawk. If you put someone like, you know, who's a businessman.
What,
like Sobyanin,
you mean? Sobyanin,
Sobyanin. I mean, the mayor of Moscow, who's like, you know, sort of commercial guy and a pragmatic administrator, then the West would look at him like, all right, we can deal with this guy and we can start our long process of ceasefire and working all of this out. I don't know. I mean, this theory appeals to me because it is actually a pragmatic way out. And then Putin remains in charge, but behind the scenes, which, you know, we've seen in pretty much every single Central Asian country is the way it's done.
Yeah.
But that may be a possibility. So we get a ceasefire at the end of this summer, and then we get this elections, we get a new president next year, and then the process of reconciliation starts. Because, again, you know, listen to the economics guys today. They were like, we're not closing Russia down. We're going to continue to be an international country. We're going to continue to trade. We've got plenty of business in Asia, so we're going to focus on that. But they're still keen to restart gas exports to the West. And there the talk has turned to making Turkey into a gas hub. And Erdogan has been talking about transmitting 100 billion cubic meters. That's two-thirds of what Europe used to buy from Russia. Mm-hmm. Of Turkish hub gas, which is Turkish gas, but Turkey has no gas at all. You know, it's just a ruse. But again, if you try and sell that idea to German industry, they'll be like, "That's fine, it's Turkish gas. We can buy that. So let's do that." You know,
right?
So we're going to get all sorts of stuff like that, I think, coming up in the future. You know, these ideas.
Wow. You've painted the first, you know, potentially rosier scenario than ever, because it feels like this war, you know, just is going to drag on and on. So that's a viable potential happier scenario. Like,
but in this scenario, Ben, the big offensive, Ukrainian offensive, does take place. That's
yes.
That can't be stopped now, right?
That can't be stopped. And guys, I'm weeping at the thought of it. It's going to be horrific. I don't know. I just can't see it progressing. I would be extremely surprised if they had as much luck as they did in Kharkiv. Yeah. And I can just see it being a classic, you know, World War One style whistles over the top, run into the machine guns and kill as many people as you can before you're killed. That kind of scenario. But I don't know. I mean, you know, we were speculating about the possibility of these F-16s that they've actually already been delivered. And that suddenly Ukraine comes out with this incredible firepower and blows the Russians to pieces with that sort of stuff. I mean, if I was in charge, I would do that. I would like make all the disinformation now saying, oh, it's F-16s and it takes a year to train and they're not coming to the autumn and you must not use them in the counteroffensive, and actually sneak a couple of battalion, you know, squadrons in and then use them in order to catch the Russians off guard. Because, I mean, this is the only hope Ukraine has, is somehow catching the Russians off guard and then going for this collapse. Because when they hit with a huge hammer blow, you, again, like you were saying, Mark, the first 24 hours, you could cause absolute chaos and the whole defense could fall to pieces. And you wouldn't take back all the territory, but you would, like, you know, again, have a spectacular victory. And then if you wanted to call peace talks, you know, because Putin would be politically on his back foot then, having been defeated or at least made to look an idiot again, that then he might be willing to do a deal. And because, you know, the Russians themselves, they want this to stop. They want to start the process of undoing sanctions. They want to go back to business. And they're happy to live, you know, in this sort of sanctioned state. But they'll start working to undo that. And the West, you know, they want this to stop. Europeans definitely want it to stop. And everyone wants to go back to work.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, exactly. I would just say that, you know, even if it is the probing phase or shaping phase of the counteroffensive, nevertheless, you know, you want that phase to go well. You don't, I mean, I put it this way, Ukraine has not done too well against, like, they have not even reached the first real line of defense. They're still even, where some of those main battles have taken place, like at Orikhiv, it stalled out at Velika Novosilka. They made a couple of, I mean, they progressed a few settlements down, but that the battles at Makarivka have been savage for both sides, actually. But the Ukrainians lost several Leopards and several Bradleys. And some of those are going to be brought to...
I was looking at the BBC coverage of that particular advance, and it's very nervous in a way that most Western coverage has not been nervous. It just says that the offensive is underway, and that there are It's continuing with modest gains. And then the humanitarian efforts continue. It's the tone of journalists who don't really have a cue yet to find the tone. And then I went and looked up the these towns, like one of them with the amusing name of Niskuchne.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I mean, these are hamlets.
That means
these
not are, boring people. Yeah, yeah, hamlets, yeah. That's a way of putting it. Yeah.
But look, I mean, we've seen lots of video of Ukrainian soldiers raising the flag over liberated villages, but a lot of these villages are just, they're abandoned. They're empty.
Yeah, they're like three farms, you know. And I don't mean to put the Ukrainians have already proven themselves that they're great fighters, you know, in this war. But this is, I think this gets back to impossible task. That is kind of our point here, right?
Yeah. But again, the report is there. I mean, like, you know, Ukrainians are on the offensive. And so that's a spectacular story. And you've got flags over liberated villages. That's a spectacular story. But I mean, at the moment, I'm reserving judgment because until I see companies of tanks accompanied by hundreds of infantry soldiers going in hard on a particular line, then I'd say the counteroffensive has started properly. I mean, you put it right. I mean, our first piece, we said like phase one has started.
Yeah.
But it's phase two, when you see all of that hardware brought onto the field, concentrated into some sort of, you know, pincer movement or a frontal attack, you know, then we could say the counteroffensive started. But as far as the reporting, you know, there's been a change in phase in the style of fighting. And so everyone's hyping it up because this remains a front page story. And, you know, for Zelensky, he's happy about that. I mean, but if you listen to Zelensky's speeches, he's already starting to manage expectations. He's talking about it, how hard it's going to be. It's going to be tough, you know. He's trying, I think, to manage expectations a bit and preparing people for, you know, the casualties, for the real brutal fight that I believe is still to come. Because it's
To put it crudely, I mean, the counteroffensive is, it's both an existential fight for Ukraine itself, but because Ukraine is so dependent on Western help, it's a marketing campaign too. We can do this to get more aid, more money, and more weaponry. And that's just the reality. I wanted to bring up something here real quickly that's sort of tied to this as well. And Ben, since you have people in Kyiv, I'm wondering if you've heard anything along these lines or if you might in the future. There was a really good article. I don't often like to say I read a good article in the New Yorker. I don't like David Remnick, but this was, you know, probably the best war article I've read in English, called 2 Weeks at the Front in Ukraine, by Luke Mogelson. And I really recommend anybody.
It was excellent. Yeah.
You know
what
I'm talking
about.
Right?
Yeah. It was really good.
It shows you the Ukrainian infantry as real people. I mean, when you're online and social media and, you know, and or a pundit or whatever, all of this becomes these people. If you haven't spent a lot of time there, that's why I think for people like us who've spent time in Russia and Ukraine with these people, it's such a hateful war because this shouldn't be happening. For other people, it's like democracy versus autocracy, or, you know, NATO versus, you know, NATO imperialists versus the anti-imperialists, whatever. It's like, no, these are people. And it's brutal, brutal war. But one of the parts that I thought was, and I've seen this hinted about, I saw Anatole Levin write a little bit about this, but this is the first kind of, the most kind of visceral account of this, the kind of class aspect to the war on the Ukraine side. And I wonder how this might affect Ukraine morale as they're being thrown into, you know, really the most difficult offensive that Europeans have seen, you know, since World War II, which is, well, let me just read this and then, you know, can talk about it. But here I'm just reading. In February 24th, 2022, so right after the invasion, Zelensky declared a general mobilization for male citizens between the ages of 18 and 60. Civilians of all stripes flocked to the military registration offices eager to fight. Some waited in line for days only to be told that no more men were required. Today, popular support for resisting rather than negotiating with Russia remains high, But as in every war, the burden of sacrifice has fallen increasingly on the underprivileged. Nearly every draftee I met in the trenches had been a manual laborer, farmer, carpenter, dock worker, plumber, and stories abounded of Ukrainians with means dodging conscription through graft or nepotism. Quote, you could find people from the higher classes in the infantry at the beginning of the war, one veteran told me, but after a year, you don't see an end to this. Your chances of dying are higher. You're fucking tired. Now most of the people are being drafted, unquote. The preponderance of draftees and the corresponding dearth of professional soldiers has shifted more responsibility onto the officer corps, which has also been diminished. Lieutenants and captains whose duties were traditionally more administrative have become frontline fighters.
We're seeing in Kiev, our guy was reporting that the police are taking people off the train, issuing them draft notices, because Ukraine, and this is underreported, but there's a few reports that Ukraine is also having a manpower problem.
Right.
And they're increasingly becoming more aggressive about it. And there was a change in the rules, and there was actually a demonstration against it whereby the state gave itself basically unlimited powers to draft people, which wasn't popular, but the story didn't get much play. Because that piece was describing, you know, you have to remember that this war actually started 8 years ago.
Yes. Mm.
So you had 250,000 veterans who'd fought in this war for 8 years, who really knew what they were doing, battle-hardened, you know, really good soldiers. And that article was describing about 80% of them are dead.
Yeah.
So your veterans, your best fighters who can lead these patrols have dwindled. And that of the every 10 conscripts you get, there's only about three of them that are actually capable of fighting or even half willing to do it. But it's the same on the Russian side. You know, they have the same manpower problems. And this is going to be an issue. And it's why time is on Putin's side, because of his population advantage, 3.5 to 1. It means that even if the Ukrainians are killing 2 Russians for every 1 of them that die, you're actually losing that war because you're going to run out of men before the Russians do. So Ukraine's in a very difficult position now. And with, like I was saying before, this is what's so worrying about this counteroffensive, is they've got 1 million people in the field. But if 80% of the veterans have died, you know, you've got an effective fighting force of 200,000. You've got another, 800,000, of which only another 200,000-300,000 are any good at fighting. You've got another 500,000 people who are useless, who are basically going to be cannon fodder. So if they do this frontal assault, you know, it's the inexperienced bricklayers, you know, who don't want to be there, who are going to get shoved to the front at some point. And the casualty rate is going to be horrific. The casualty rate is already by far the worst since the Second World War. Hundreds of thousands.
We interviewed someone who, can't remember the name now, who was visiting the lines, and what he stressed was the mines. The Russian forces have had so much time to lay mines.
Yeah, that was Levin also. Yeah. And that's true, and you're seeing that in the Zaporizhia attacks too. It's just mines. And what is more demoralizing than seeing people you're with dying, not from getting, not in live combat, but just getting blown up by mines, you know?
Yeah. And this is the Russian lines. And those leopards that got destroyed, it's because it wasn't because they were blown up. It's because they wandered into a minefield.
Right.
I mean, according to reports I saw. And that's what the assault is about. The counteroffensive assault is going to have to drive over minefields. I mean, the Russians are prepared thoroughly and have mined that whole strip. The World Bank gave an initial estimate of how much it would cost to demine Ukraine, and they were talking about $5 billion.
Oof.
The farmers, too, they've got a problem with, they should be showing the crops, but they're saying something like 10-15% of the land, they can't go onto it because it's covered with mines. So there's huge swathes of land that should be sown that can't
be. Well, every time there's a war with minefields, children especially are dying for decades afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the last thing to wrap this up, just talk a little bit about the crazy. I'll tell you a little crazy over here, and maybe you could tell me a little bit of the crazy over there. I mean, well, we talked about the Czech Republic's president proposing to round up all ethnic Russians and put them into camps. Today, there was, in The Guardian, that Peter Pomerantsev of Peace, basically doing phrenology on Russians, that they're genetically predisposed to just wanton terror, unlike the Nazis, who had rules, dude. He literally quotes somebody saying, the Nazis at least had rules, dude, but the Stalin.
And he wasn't quoting Big Lebowski?
No, it was some Ukrainian podcasters that Pomerantsev listens to. Well, it was
because the Coen brothers got there first. At least it was an ethos.
Yeah, it was like Stalin, that there were rules. If you were a Jew or a communist, this is just a stupid world revisionist misconception that the Nazis had rules. They've slaughtered everybody. I mean, what the fuck are they thinking? They were savages, maybe they didn't. If you were a German, you would get killed by the Russians, I guess. But if you were German, they wouldn't necessarily slaughter you. But everywhere they went, they were killing people. That's just so stupid. It was this Volodymyr Yarmolenko, this philosopher who's gotten a lot of popularity with a neocon class. But when you go and look at his tweets and the things he talks about, his whole line is Russia is Asiatic. And I mean, you probably heard this a lot when you travel around the former Soviet anti-Russian countries, Ben, in your years. They're not European like us. They're Asia. It's all this like yellow peril stuff that goes back a long ways as well. But anyway, then you have Elizabeth Gilbert, a very famous novelist, Eat, Pray, Love, who I guess she announced that she had a new novel coming out. And that it was going to be
set in
Siberia, like 70 years ago, some group of people, Russians, who were, against the Soviet system and somehow resisted it. And her Goodreads page got flooded by Ukrainian or pro-Ukrainian, or maybe it was even just a troll farm. And she didn't know how to deal with it, saying, how dare you set anything in Russia? Don't you know Russians are ethnically evil? And so she gave this like almost tearful video of herself posting, saying she was withdrawing the novel.
Oh,
she's not
going to
publish it because it paints ethnic Russians in a good light.
Oh, my God.
You didn't hear about this, John? Yeah.
And so I was still stuck on Peter Pomerantsev massively misreading Crime and Punishment.
I
couldn't get past that.
That's right. And he said that Raskolnikov murdered just for fun, just for no reason, whatever. It's just like he woke up one day.
But that's what's so tragic about this whole war. I mean, all three of us have spent a considerable amount of time in Russia. And we know that, the Russians, Ukrainians, there was, no separation there. You live in Moscow and every second person you meet is like a mom or a babushka or like girlfriend who's Ukrainian. And no one cared. I mean, they were brothers. I mean, there was a bit of tension. The Russians, they are arrogant at the end of the day.
Out in Lvov, the Russians could be arrogant. That's true. And out in Lvov, I did notice it was different there, right? But you didn't really meet. I mean, if you went to Kyiv or, anywhere in eastern Ukraine, or people from Kyiv or eastern.
Well, yeah. Most I mean, if you go Ukraine, to Indiana and you look coastal, or as happened in my experience, you go to Colorado Springs and you and your taxi driver says, "We don't want your kind around here, I swear to God."
Colorado Springs is a special town, man.
That's funny. But I mean, that's not going to break the culture apart.
It's just the hate that's been engendered now. It's stunning. Yeah. Yeah. And it makes you cry. I mean, this didn't need to be like this. And there's still 3 million Ukrainians living in Russia. Yeah. And, the number one destination for refugees leaving Ukraine has been to go to Russia because you speak the same language. You don't need a work permit. You've got family and friends there. You can get a job. And when you're in Moscow or wherever, Nizhny Novgorod or Tagil or whatever, No one gives a shit. They like give you a job and they're just like, oh, the war is terrible, but you know, you're here and I need help on Saturdays, so come and work. Yeah. But the hate, and on the Ukrainian side, I mean, they've dug in. Yeah. There was another poll this week saying that whatever it was, 84% of Ukrainians are not prepared to make any territorial concessions whatsoever in any peace talks. You know, and that really sort of nails Zelensky's feet to the floor.
That's what I was saying, you know, about your scenario, which makes sense and gives you hope. But politically, I don't know that he can do even a ceasefire of any kind.
Think of the U.S. Civil War in its later stages, the First World War, circa 1916, 1917. I mean, when the casualty lists start to come back, unfortunately, that might be how it works when the casualty lists start to
but
come back.
But this is why I was doing this thing about Zelensky's gamble, because if this counteroffensive goes wrong, that one of the upshots could be easily that, you know, because he is a statesman in so much as in April, he actually negotiated a peace deal with Russians. Kozak said it, and it was Israeli minister who was involved.
Bennett, you mean April of 22, right.
And so a deal was done. And this was, I mean, he was interviewed in Bucha at the site of the massacre by the BBC saying, and they asked him, is the deal still on? And he says, like, despite these terrible events, that yes, I'm still prepared to talk to the Russians because we need to end this. You know, it's a real statesman, rise above it, see the, you know. But then in Boris Johnson, came in and screwed that up by telling him that the West wouldn't support him if he tried. And so, you know, the deal blew up. But if he again has a disastrous counteroffensive and he does go to the Russians and say, all right, I concede this is unwinnable, we need to stop the killing, then he'll get crucified by his own people. And so he, like Churchill, will end up being out of office and handed over to someone else. I mean, this is all also possibilities. Anyway, but the point being is that he's taking a big gamble and it really needs to come off. But it could go wrong in so many ways.
Yeah. So we're going to keep obviously watching what happens and not enjoying it. That's the one thing, another thing about this war I have to say, and I'm sure you've seen this a lot, Ben, too, that just really bothers me is how much joy people on both sides, but what really bothers me most is seeing my own like American or, you know, Western compatriots, just how much joy they get out of the killing if they perceive that their side is getting the better side, the better end of the killing, even like, you know, this brutal shark attack in Hurghada and then all these people making fun of the Russian
that actually,
who was killed.
Hit me hard. It shows the depth of war madness in the centrist public in the English-speaking world at the moment. Like, you could watch this guy getting tossed around by a massive tiger shark that was basically eventually using torque and teeth to chew pieces off him. And a lot of people who normally do this saner than thou stuff were cheering for it
and loving it, and you know, we're not talking about Ukrainians here. Ukrainians themselves have every right to hate on invaders and to be crazy about, although it sucks, you know, but it's just Paul Massaro, U.S. government employee, you know, National Endowment for Democracy guy, putting out memes of the shark killing this guy who never was even in the war. He just happens to be ethnic Russian. Mm. It is not fucking good. I'm just so sick of it, man.
I don't know. Look, because I've spent the better part of my adult career covering Russia, Eastern Europe in general, but Russia in particular, and have watched it. You know, I was there in 93, 18 months after the war came down, when it was totally on its back, completely collapsed. I mean, the shops were empty, the lights were off, I mean, literally. Yes. And then watched 30 years, you know, my friends who used to earn $10 a month, you know, built companies, had families. And I'm not just talking about Russia, because the first place I ever went in Eastern Europe was Kiev. And I lived there for like several months and go backwards and forwards between the two. And then to watch all of that work and the whole thing come through transformation and settle down and stabilize and people build careers and to see the whole thing destroyed, you know, in the matter of 1 year, And made Russia a pariah, so it can't come back from this. And yeah. the Ukrainian story, I mean, this is not being talked about, but demographically, it's been decimated. Yeah. The population's gone from 45 million to 29. And the UN 52 just
52 million. It was 52 million in 91, or 89 or something,
And the UN just came out with a report and said that the population will never recover, and it will probably shrink to 20 million now. And moreover, the destruction, you know, we're talking about $1 trillion now, you know, at least 200 billion for the physical damage. And if you think that the West is going to come up with that money, if you think the private investors are going to come up with that money, dream on. You know, the Ukrainians, when they stop, are going to be left on their own resources, and they're going to have to rebuild it from scratch with very, very little money, some IMF money, you know, a couple of tens of billions. And so the country's been destroyed for a generation. And it's just tragic because, you know, Ukraine was finally starting to look like it was getting its act together after 30 years of being a basket case. And Zelensky was saying the right things and beginning to make some progress. And now it's all smashed to pieces. I don't know. Here in Germany, we've got whatever it is, a couple of million of, Ukrainian refugees. And the ones I talk to is like, you know, yes, of course, I miss home and I don't really fit in here, but I'm not going back.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is, and that's,
life is really good here. And kids are in school and they're great medical and, you know, I'm staying. They've given me a residence permit, I'm staying. So that guts the country of 8 million active people. And they're all women as well, which means that the fertility rates are going to crash because all the women are here.
Yeah.
So this is why the population is going to shrink. And you can't build an economy with a shrinking population that's going to go down by another third, you know, in the next 5 years. So it's all horrible. It's horrible.
It's horrible. And I think on that note, because that's how we try to end every show, on the lowest note possible, I think we can end this episode. Thank you again so much for joining us
Pleasure.
Ben Aris,
BNE
and Telenews.
John.
We'll post links again to his excellent site. And thanks again for joining us. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye. Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.